Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Christy, and I'll be reading Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, July 12, 2023. Changing Lives. Maybe Foundation gives $25 million to Permian Basin Behavioral Health Center. By Ben Schaefer, staff writer. As a part of its 75th celebration, the J.E. and L.E. Maybe Foundation is giving a $25 million gift to the Permian Basin Behavioral Health Center, according to a press release from the foundation. The J.E. and L.E. Maybe Foundation was established with the intent of supporting worthy organizations in the communities where the founders lived or worked, said John Maybe, chairman of the Maybe Foundation. This special grant reflects the values of John E. and Lottie E. Maybe, and the board is proud to continue supporting their legacy. The Permian Basin Behavioral Health Center will fill a long-standing void by providing quality mental health resources for the entire region. PBBHC's principal building will be named the J.E. and L.E. Maybe Foundation Permian Basin Behavioral Health Center, the press release states. With this extraordinary gift, the Maybe Foundation has made a profound statement about the importance of bringing high-quality behavioral health services to the Permian Basin, said Russell Myers, president of the PBBHC. We are incredibly grateful to receive this grant, placing us one giant step closer to providing this much-needed service to the residents of our region. Previous Reporter Telegram articles have stated that the center's first 100 beds were partially funded in October 2021 by the Texas legislature with a one-time appropriation of $40 million. State Representative Tom Craddock announced in May that $86.7 million in new funding have been secured that will allow for a 100-bed expansion. A capital funding request was reported in March, including $65 million for the 100-bed expansion, $10.5 million for infrastructure planning, design, and construction to the Permian Basin Behavioral Health Center site, and $11.2 million in startup funding for PBBHC workforce. The current estimate of the total project cost has increased to $130 million, according to Myers, who has transitioned from Midland Health CEO to a developmental role for the Midland Memorial Foundation, focusing on the completion of the Permian Basin Behavioral Health Center and other developmental projects. Myers stated in May that the state's $40 million appropriation has been supplemented by $43.3 million in contributions and confirmed pledges. The Permian Basin Behavioral Health Center is a joint venture between Midland Health and Medical Center Health System in Odessa. Officials broke ground on the project in April. The center will be located between Midland and Odessa on 54 acres donated by Diamondback Energy, adjacent to the University of Texas Permian Basin's Midland campus. Council unified in their support of Gonzalez as new city manager. By Stuart Doreen, staff writer. The Midland City Council was unanimous in its support for Tommy Gonzalez as its next city manager. The 7-0 vote showed the Midland City Council could come together when it needed to hire a chief executive. I think all seven of us on the council value our relationship with staff, and we really want the opportunity to work with people who know that they have our support, Midland Mayor Lori Blong said after Tuesday's meeting. And so, as we're building a team, we have five appointees that the city and the city council directly hires, and we believe this is an opportunity for us to show unity of support around the people that we hire and unity going forward. As we're making decisions, we do not always vote the same, and we won't in the future. We will have disagreements, but I think in matters of personnel hires and high-profile personnel hires, particularly, it's been important to us to come to a decision that we can agree on. Gonzalez comes to the city of Midland from El Paso, where he served as city manager before being let go earlier this year. His record also included stops in Lubbock, Harlingen, Dallas, and Irving in a list of headlines long enough to worry Midlanders about if city leaders are making an appropriate selection. Council members talked about messages they received if Gonzalez was the right fit. On Tuesday, three people came to City Council chamber inside City Hall to state on the record their displeasure for the selection or the process. But the council was unanimous in their approval for the lone finalist. They agreed on a contract that will pay a base salary of $350,000. Blong stated there won't be a high-dollar severance package if things go sideways with Gonzalez. The contract limits a severance to 1 year's salary if he is excused without cause and 6 months' salary if he is excused with cause. City leaders stated there were around 100 applicants and face-to-face interviews led to the selection of Gonzalez as the final candidate. They were unified in their vetting of Gonzalez prior to the unanimous vote. At large, council member Dan Corrales stated that the council had put a lot of thought into the decision and done its due diligence to do what is best for the city. He asked that the community put its confidence in its elected officials that we have been doing our homework. District 2 Representative John Norman stated that as elected officials, we have constituents who elected us. They elected us for a reason. District 3 Councilman Jack Ladd added one can find information about city managers being fired in cities across the state and that the average time for a city manager in a particular city is 4 years. It is a very political job. If a city manager is doing their job right, they are taking arrows for the city council and staff. At large, Councilwoman Robin Poole said a lot of work went into the decision and she stands by her vote. And Amy Stretcher Burks said she shared her concerns about the contract and severance package. Dangerous heat wave set to strain power grid by Brian K. Sullivan, Bloomberg. A record-breaking heat wave is about to send temperatures soaring from California to the Gulf of Mexico, posing health risk and straining power grids for days to come. Temperatures will topple daily records across California, Nevada, and Arizona this weekend, hitting or nearly all-time highs in some areas, said Zach Taylor, a senior branch forecaster at the U.S. Weather Prediction Center. To the east, heat will also push into Texas and along the Gulf Coast, where humidity will add to the misery. That is going to become extremely dangerous, given the intensity and longevity, Taylor said. Even beyond this week, we are looking at a continuation of this heat wave. Stifling heat set records last month across Texas and Mexico, taxing electric grids in both places as demand soared. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which operates the state's grid, said demand reached an unofficial peak of 80.8 gigawatts on June 27th, and it says more all-time highs are possible this week. Blistering weather hasn't only been a problem for the U.S. this week. Extreme heat is bearing down on Europe from Germany to the Balkans, putting pressure on the region's energy and transportation systems as river levels drop. It's further evidence that climate change is raising temperatures and triggering heat waves that are more frequent and more acute. Extreme weather is withering crops, upending transportation networks, and taking down electric grids. Factor in humidity, and it's also testing the limits of human survival. Excessive heat warnings and watches are posted across California, Nevada, and Arizona, where temperatures could near 120 degrees in some places. The National Weather Service said, to the east, heat advisories reach from New Mexico across Texas in South Florida. High temperatures in Dallas and San Antonio could reach 102 degrees starting Wednesday, with humidity making it feel as high as 111, the National Weather Service said. Hamilton coming to Lubbock, some $10 tickets still available, by Morgan Taylor Thomas, staff writer. Renowned and award-winning musical Hamilton will take over the Buddy Holly Hall in Lubbock from July 19th to the 30th. Based on the biography written by Ron Chernow, Hamilton tells the life story of founding father Alexander Hamilton through modern blends of hip-hop, jazz, R&B, and Broadway. Acclaimed lyrical genius Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote the stage adaptation along with the music while Thomas Keel directed. presented by the American Theater Guild, the nation's largest non-for-profit touring Broadway presenter. A Ham for Ham lottery will take place for each show, offering 40 tickets at $10 each. Lottery will run from 10 a.m. Friday through noon Thursday for that week's upcoming performances, i.e. the lottery for July 19th through the 23rd performances, opened at 10 a.m. on July 7th and will close at noon Thursday. To enter, a few rules apply. First, customers must be 18 years or older. Second, the Hamilton app download at www.hamiltonmusic.com/app must be used to enter the lottery. Guests can only enter the lottery for each round of show once repeat entries and disposable emails will be removed. From there, winner and non-winner notifications will be sent via email push notification between 1 and 4 p.m. every Thursday for the upcoming week's performances and must be claimed and paid for within 2 hours. Pickup starts 2 hours prior to the show at will call with a valid ID. If awarded a lottery ticket, the $10 prize cannot be used for prior purchases nor combined with other offers and promotions. For more info on Hamilton, visit hamiltonmusical.com at facebook.com/Hamilton Musical or Instagram.com/Hamilton Musical or Twitter.com/Hamilton Musical. Note, if you choose to purchase non-lottery tickets, Broadway at BuddyHollyHall.com, BuddyHollyHall.com, and the box office are the only official Hamilton ticket sellers for the Lubbock performances. Tickets bought on other sites cannot be guaranteed to work at Buddy Holly Hall. Midland ISD is looking for Chief Financial Officer by Stuart Doreen, staff writer. Midland ISD is looking for a Chief Financial Officer. The district on its website posted a job listing for a Chief Financial Officer on Monday. The district has not yet reached out to say what the reason is for the listing. Daryl Dodds has been Chief Financial Officer with Midland ISD since early 2020. The Chief Financial Officer, according to the district, is responsible for the following functions and purposes: is responsible for oversight of all financial and business affairs of the district, provides leadership for the district's financial services activity to ensure legally sound and effective management practices, directs and monitors the management and investment of all district funds and ensure they are adequately protected, serves as a chief financial advisor and budget advisor to the superintendent and board of trustees. The district's 2023-24 compensation manual shows the salary range for the chief financial officer is $148,789 to $201,302. MPD hunt for suspect in truck theft by Mercedes Cadero, staff writer. The Midland Police Department is seeking information that will help identify a suspect who stole a vehicle from a North Midland apartment complex. On July 4th, the suspect stole a white 2022 Ford F-250 from the Sundance Creek Apartments located at 3700 Edwards Street during the morning hours. The suspect was captured on video by a camera inside the vehicle. He is wanted for unauthorized use of a vehicle, a state felony. If a person is the first to submit any information on the suspect and it leads to an arrest, he or she will be eligible for a cash reward. Call Midland Crime Stoppers at 694-TIPS or download the Crime Stoppers app at P3-TIPS and submit an anonymous mobile tip. No caller ID is ever used, and those providing information will remain anonymous. Reference MPD case number 230704008. Midland Police make arrest in June ATV crash by Mercedes Cadero, staff writer. A 27-year-old man has been arrested Monday in connection to a June ATV accident in Central Midland that resulted in two juveniles being airlifted to a Lubbock hospital. David P. David was being held Thursday in Midland County Jail on two counts of abandoning slash endangering child, imminent danger, bodily injury, second-degree felonies. Bond is set at $50,000 for each charge. On June 11th, at about 9:24 p.m., the Midland Police Department's Traffic Division responded to a serious bodily injury crash involving an ATV and a pickup in the 2100 block of Barber Street. According to the arrest affidavit, a Ford F-350 pickup was traveling northbound on Barber Street, and a Yamaha ATV occupied by three people was traveling eastbound in the alley of the 300 block of Elm Avenue. The ATV, driven by David, entered the roadway to cross Barber Street and struck the pickup. All three occupants were ejected from the ATV. The pickup driver told MPD officers he didn't see the ATV and heard when it hit his truck. He stopped and saw the two little girls and a man on the ground, according to the arrest affidavit. The ATV occupants, David and two juveniles, were transported to the hospital. The two juveniles were then airlifted to a Lubbock hospital with life-threatening injuries. Officers also learned that the ATV driven by David was reported stolen out of Potter County in Amarillo. David was arrested on a warrant after officers found that he knowingly operated a stolen ATV in violation of Texas Transportation Code in a reckless manner, to include no helmets or safety glasses, and did not have an illuminated taillight, and it is unknown if the headlight was illuminated at the time of the crash. The affidavit also states he failed to stop before crossing a roadway, resulting in the collision with the pickup that seriously injured the two juvenile occupants. With the extent of the damage to the ATV, officers determined it was traveling at an unsafe speed. Nuevo Vista Golf Club to close July 24th by Mella McEwen, staff writer. Nueva Vista Golf Club site of a hotly disputed development plan is closing its doors July 24th. Television station KWES reported Tuesday that an email sent to members by John Crane, listed on the golf club's website as a golfer, said the golf club will be closing July 24th at the end of the day and would not be charging membership dues or member cart fees or range balls for the duration. Merchandise is on sale at 20% off to the public, 25% off for members. Neighbors and supporters of Nuevo Vista in 2021 hotly disputed the development plans that would have seen Nueva Vista turned into 626 residential lots, 113 single-family lots, and 145 single-family two lots, 137 single-family lots, and 177 townhome lots and 54 garden home lots, as well as a 2.34-acre amenity center. This is a 220-acre parcel used as a golf course, Eric West, Sector Director of Site Development and Planning with Parkhill, told Planning and Zoning Commissioners as they narrowly voted to approve a zone change from AE, Agriculture Estate, to PD, Planned Development District for Housing Development and Shopping Center in the fall of 2021, along with the preliminary plat for the development. There has been speculation that the property has or will be sold. NWS, expect a high of 107 degrees Wednesday by Stuart Doreen, staff writer. The number of 100-degree days in 2023 hit 20 on Tuesday, and that number will grow. The National Weather Service showed a high temperature of 105 degrees on Tuesday, the third straight 100-degree day at Midland International Airport. The NWS also showed in its 7-day forecast that triple-digit high temperatures are expected through at least July 18th. That would result in a streak of 10 straight 100-degree days. One record set on Tuesday appears to be for a low temperature, according to the National Weather Service. The low temperature was 82 degrees, according to the NWS. That is a warmer low temperature than the 79 degrees in 2016. There is no rain in the 7-day forecast, according to the NWS, but winds on Wednesday could gust as high as 30 miles per hour. Weather report, Tuesday's high, 105 degrees. Typical high for July 11th, 96 degrees. Tuesday's low, 83 degrees. Typical low for July 11th, 73 degrees. Record high for July 11th, 107 in 2016. Last 3 days, Sunday, 103 degrees. Monday, 103 degrees. Tuesday, 105 degrees. Next 3 days, Wednesday, 107 degrees. Thursday, 106 degrees. Friday, 103 degrees. And the source, National Weather Service. This is Business in Oil. Oil rises as Russian crude output drops, China signals stimulus, by Julia Vanzeres and Grant Smith, Bloomberg. Oil rose amid indications that Russian crude production is dropping, signaling the market's supply glut may be coming to an end. Average shipments for Russian crude have dropped below their February averages, according to fresh data, a key development in a market that has been held down this year by the Kremlin's stronger-than-anticipated crude exports. Adding to bullish sentiment is news that China will take more steps to revive its economy with additional stimulus. West Texas Intermediate rose above $74 a barrel, surpassing its 100-day moving average, which has been a key resistance level in past months. Crude's recent moves have been exaggerated by lower summer trading volumes. Analysts at the U.S. government and Standard Chartered PLC are now forecasting supply deficits over the coming months on expectations demands will climb. Still, crude is down 6.7% this year on China's weakness, fears of a global economic slowdown due to monetary tightening by central banks, and resilient supply from producers including Russia and Iran. In a recent effort to prop up the market, OPEC, heavyweights Saudi Arabia and Russia, have pledged even more supply reductions. Traders will be watching over the U.S. Consumer Price Index on Wednesday for clues on the path forward for interest rates and monthly reports from OPEC and the International Energy Agency on Thursday for snapshots of the oil market. OPEC revenue in 2022, highest in almost a decade, by Grant Smith, Bloomberg. OPEC's petroleum export revenues climbed to a highest in almost a decade last year as Russia's war on Ukraine bolstered crude prices and key members ramped up production. The 13 nations of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries earned $873.6 billion in 2022, up 54% from the prior year, according to a report from the group's secretariat on Tuesday. It was their best year since 2014, when the U.S. shale boom ended a period of historically high oil prices. Crude soared last year as energy flows from Russia, which joined with the cartel in 2016 in a wider network known as OPEC Plus, were disrupted by international backlash against its military aggression. Brent futures averaged about $99 a barrel, the highest since 2014. Meanwhile, OPEC nations such as Saudi Arabia and the UAE opened the taps to satisfy the post-pandemic recovery in fuel demand. The combination of surging prices and increased output pushed up earnings for the entire group. The basket of crude grades typically sold by OPEC nations averaged just over $100 a barrel in 2022, while Bloomberg estimates show that crude production from its 13 states was roughly 29.2 million barrels a day. The figures for petroleum revenue also include sales of refined products. OPEC's earnings peaked at roughly $1.2 trillion in 2012, just as the use of hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking, was unloading a gusher of shale oil in American states from Texas to North Dakota. The ensuing market crash spurred the Saudis and Russia, once fierce rivals, to form the OPEC Plus coalition in 2016. Railroad crossing damage forces closure of Garfield Street lanes. Midland commuters who drive across the railroad crossing at South Garfield Street will now need to seek alternative routes. The City of Midland reported that the southbound lanes of Garfield Street at the Front Street Railroad crossing are closed indefinitely. The city cited damage to the tracks as the reason for the closure. Saudi Arabia's oil cuts begin to bite, by Alex Longley and Sharon Cho, Bloomberg. The oil market is finally starting to flicker into life, and nowhere is that clearer than in the prices of crude like Saudi Arabia's, where output cuts are quietly transforming the supply landscape. The kingdom and its partners in the OPEC Oil Producer Alliance have been restraining supply for months now, with relatively little impact on the futures market. Brent oil traded in London had been stuck around the $75 a barrel mark for weeks. That shifted a little Friday when the contracts rose to about $78, a level they have largely held at since. But the tiny and tentative rally tells only part of the story. Brent oil differs to the kind produced by Saudi Arabia in two important aspects: its density and sulfur content, and across the world where varieties of crude more closely resemble those of the world's top exporter, prices are shooting up faster as refineries clamor for alternatives to the barrels that the kingdom has cut. Meanwhile, supplies of lighter, sweeter oil that's similar to West Texas Intermediate and Brent, the world's main futures grades, have been relatively plentiful. Mediums and heavy sour barrels are becoming increasingly scarce, given OPEC's cuts, said Michael Tran, managing director at RBC Capital Markets, LLC. Much of the physical looseness in the market has stemmed from lighter, sweeter barrels, and sneaky, surging U.S. shale production has been underappreciated. In the Middle East, important market time spreads such as intermonth Dubai oil swaps are also pointing to higher supplies for what is flagship price for the region's medium and heavier sour grades. The rally has created an expectation that Asia's refiners may look further afield for cargoes. Diesel. Oil bulls have pointed to sharp jumps in premiums for refined fuels as a sign that, despite fears of global economic slowdown, consumption remains healthy. Even though microeconomic data suggest a global manufacturing recession, Europe's diesel benchmark, the fuel most closely linked to the region's industrial production, last week spiked relative to later months on concerns about scarce supply. By contrast, some lighter crudes have been hurt by weak demand for products like naphtha amid anemic margins in the petrochemicals industry. Those moves, alongside relatively robust markets for gasoline and fuel oil, are also shaping the crude refiners' look to buy, improving the attractiveness of heavier grades. Heavy rallies. Signs of strength in heavier oil prices can be seen everywhere amid the start of new refineries in the Middle East and Asia, and a long-lasting halt in Iraqi oil exports via the Turkish port of Cayenne. Wildfires in Canada that sent oil production to the lowest in 2 years are also adding to concerns. The premium of Norway's Johan Sverdrup above a regional benchmark served to a fresh record on Friday, having been a hefty discount as recently as December. Mars Blend soared to a 3-year high last week, and industry consultant Energy Aspects forecast the supply of sour grades from the U.S. Gulf Coast to stay tight this quarter. Ongoing purchases by the U.S. government to refill its strategic reserve have also helped boost sour crudes. Western Canada Select was recently at a discount of $10 to NYMEX WTI benchmark prices, which is the strongest level seen since the government of Alberta implemented an OPEC-style production cut of 325,000 barrels a day between 2019 and 2021. In contrast, light sweet suppliers such as West Texas Intermediate Midland Crude remain relatively well supplied. Record volumes of the flagship U.S. grade have been flooding the European market since its introduction into the region's physical oil benchmark, dated Brent. The move has also weighed on prices since it came into effect earlier this year. The spread between Abu Dhabi Murban crude versus Dubai swaps has been narrowing too. Following Saudi Arabia's price hike for August loading barrels, the premium of the comparatively light Murban started to shrink on a relative basis, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. Brent Dubai. Brent swaps contracts have traded at a rare discount to Dubai swaps. In recent days, following a precipitous slide over the past few months, the slide creates potential pricing arbitrages to entice Asian refineries to purchase long-distance crudes. Some refiners there have already been snapping up millions of U.S. barrels, along with some cargoes from West Africa, in the spot market, according to traders. In the last move, at least two processors in Asia sought less from the Saudis for cargoes shipped next month, and another said it won't take any cargoes after an unexpected price increase. Connie Jean Baird was born in Haskell County, Texas, on April 28, 1934, to Velma and Wynn Baird. A memorial service will be held at 4 p.m. Saturday, July 15, 2023, at the branch at NPW at 3800 North Big Spring Street in Midland. Graveside services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, July 19. Cemetery 5750 U.S. 277 in Abilene, Texas, 79606. Donations to a charity of your choice will be greatly appreciated. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Geraldine Porter Good of Midland passed away at 91 years of age on Wednesday, July 6, 2023. Geraldine, or Jerry as she was known, was born May 27, 1932, in Stonewall, Oklahoma, to Cora and Wiley Porter. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory. The funeral service was held on Sunday, July 9, 2023, at 2 p.m. Carol Ann Lounsbury of Midland passed away on June 27, 2023. Memorial service will be held at Crestview Baptist Church in Midland at 10 a.m. on Monday, July 17. Online condolences may be made at www.mpwelch.com. Jesus Alfonso Garcia, 57, of Midland, passed away on July 9, 2023. Viewing will be held Thursday, July 13, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a rosary to be recited at 7 p.m. Thursday evening at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. A funeral mass will be held at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine Friday, July 14, at 10 a.m. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Garden. Funeral services will be under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our webpage at LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Susan Craig Mahoney of Midland, Texas, passed away on Wednesday, May 31, 2023, at the age of 67. A celebration of life will be held Saturday, July 15th, 2023, at 11 a.m. at Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home.
The Odessa American News for July the 12th. Top story is two arrested in Saturday homicide. Two people have been arrested in connection with Saturday's death of a 35-year-old man. According to the Ector County Sheriff's Office, Nicholas Sebolt, 25, and Lori Granham, 51, were arrested on suspicion of murder and were booked into the Ector County Adult Detention Center. Deputies were dispatched to the 2600 block of West 56th Street around 6:20 p.m. Saturday about an ambulance run. When they arrived, they discovered Jurup von Bristenson dead from a gunshot wound to the head. Anyone with information concerning this investigation is encouraged to contact investigator Jay Calderon at the Ector County Sheriff's Office at 432-335-3050 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS. T-I-P-S. Book sales, a lure for money, and more takeaways from the AP investigation into Supreme Court ethics. Washington. In a months-long inquiry, which included reviewing tens of thousands of pages of documents from more than 100 public records requests, the Associated Press has examined what happens behind the scenes when Supreme Court justices travel to colleges and universities for lectures and other events. The AP learned the identities of donors and politicians invited to events with justices, details about the perks that have accompanied the school visits, and information about how school trips have helped advance book sales. The documents reveal how university visits are a convenient way for justices to sell their own books. That's especially true in the case of Justice Sonia Sotomayor, a prolific author who has kept the court's most active travel schedule over the past decade, according to the records reviewed by the AP. Emails and other documents show that Supreme Court staff members have been directly engaged in facilitating book sales by asking schools how many copies they want to buy and by helping to arrange the purchase of mass quantities. At a 2015 event jointly hosted by Multnomah County Library in Oregon and Portland Community College, a Sotomayor aide told organizers that 250 books is definitely not enough for a program with an expected 1,000 guests in which people would be required to have a copy to meet the justice for a signing after the event. Michigan State University purchased 11,000 copies to be distributed to incoming first-year students. When Clemson University in South Carolina worried that 60 copies might be too many for Sotomayor to sign, a staffer reassured the school that most institutions order in the ranges of 400 and up. And before a scheduled visit to the law school at the University of California, Davis, for the 2018 commencement, the court staff pitched the school on signed copies of her books in connection with the event. In a statement, a Supreme Court spokesperson said that staff members work to follow judicial ethics guidance and that at no time have attendees been required to buy a book in order to attend an event. Schools have occasionally invited Justice Sotomayor to take part in a program in which they select a book for an entire school or a freshman class, and the justice gives a book talk, the statement said. When she is invited to participate in a book program, Chambers staff recommends the number of books based on the size of the audience so as not to disappoint attendees who may anticipate books being available at an event, and they will put colleges or universities in touch with the justice's publisher when asked to do so. Supreme Court justices insist that they cannot and do not participate in fundraising events. but the emails obtained by the AP show that the court's definition of a fundraiser, an event that raises more than it costs or where guests are asked for contribution, excludes much of the work that typically goes into persuading a wealthy donor to cut a check. That has given schools wide latitude to court rich patrons. For instance, ahead of a 2017 event with Justice Clarence Thomas, officials at McLennan Community College in Texas worked with the prominent conservative lawyer Ken Starr and his wife Alice to craft a guest list designed to reward school patrons and incentivize future contributions. In an interview, Starr's widow called it friend-raising. In an email planning the event, the executive director of the college's foundation wrote that she had thoughts about whom to invite, mainly because they are wealthy conservative Catholics who would align with Clarence Thomas and who have not previously given. Thomas isn't the only one whose status as a justice has been leveraged by schools eager to capitalize with donors. Before Justice Elena Kagan visited the University of Colorado's law school, one official suggested a larger donor-to-staff ratio for a 2019 dinner with her. Another event organizer said the organizer was open to suggestions about which VIP donors to cultivate relations with. A school spokesperson said the attendees weren't asked for any donations connected to the event. Clemson University in South Carolina hosted Sotomayor for a 2015 session with students and for a private luncheon. One official said it was hoped the events, which included donors, would ultimately generate resources for the university's Humanities Advancement Board, which played a lead organizing role. As university officials devised a guest list, an alumni relations official wrote, "When you say $1 million donors, please be sure to include our corporate donors at that level too." A university spokesman said the event was Sotomayor was not a fundraiser. In a statement, a court spokesperson said it routinely asks event organizers to confirm that an event at which a justice will speak is not a fundraiser, and it provides a definition of fundraiser in order to avoid misunderstandings. The spokesperson said justices have occasionally declined to attend events even after being told expressly that they were not fundraisers. Visits to universities are promoted as academic in nature, but they also have facilitated encounters between justices and elected officials. Months after he was seated on the Supreme Court, Justice Neil Gorsuch attended an event at the University of Kentucky with then-Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, hosted by a center to study the judiciary named after one of McConnell's closest friends, a former federal judge. In 2020, after teaching a week-long course at the University of Florida's Law School, Thomas attended his stay in the state to attend a gathering of the regional branch of the Federalist Society, where he was introduced with effusive praise by Governor Ron DeSantis, with whom he also had a private dinner. Thomas also attended a private dinner meeting during a visit to the University of Texas at Tyler that was sponsored by a group of donors to then-Representative Louis Gohmert. 6 years later, Gohmert would spearhead a lawsuit that sought to empower Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the outcome of the 2020 presidential election that Donald Trump lost. A court spokesperson said justices exercise caution in attending events that might be described as political in nature, following guidance in the Code of Conduct, which cautions judges against engaging in political activity. Merely attending an event where an elected official might also be in attendance, such as several of the events described in your email, does not necessarily render the event impermissibly political in nature. Some of the conduct revealed by the AP likely would run afoul of the ethics rules that cover officials in other branches of government as well as lower federal court judges. Lower court judges, for instance, are generally barred from engaging in fundraising, political activity, and lending the prestige of judicial office to advance a judge's own private interests. Supreme Court justices are asked only to adhere to what Chief Justice John Roberts referred to in April as a set of foundational ethics, principles, and practices. The information in this review comes at a time of plummeting confidence in the court, brought on in part by a succession of news media revelations about members of the court, including reports by ProPublica that Thomas repeatedly accepted luxury vacations, including a $500,000 trip to Indonesia in 2019, and sold property to and accepted school tuition for a nephew from Harlan Crow, a billionaire businessman, Republican donor, and longtime friend. After the AP stories were published, Senator Dick Durbin, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said, if they just established the basic standards of every other branch of government, it would give us much more confidence in their integrity. Obituaries. Richard Allen Davis, age 74, of Odessa, died Saturday, July the 8th, in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. July the 14th at Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Edgar David Hernandez, age 31, of Odessa, died Monday, July the 3rd, in Amarillo. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. July the 13th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Burial will follow at American Heritage Cemetery. My Grandma's Apple Strudel, a blue ribbon recipe from the Test Kitchen. The ingredients for the apple strudel are, for the apple filling, 6 cups of apples peeled and sliced, 1/2 cup of all-purpose flour, 1 cup sugar, and 1 teaspoon of cinnamon. And for the crust, 3 3/4 cup all-purpose flour, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1 tablespoon of sugar, and 1 1/2 cup of shortening, 2 egg yolks plus water to equal 1 cup, and reserve 1 egg white. The icing and the frosting is 1 cup of powdered sugar, 2 tablespoons of milk or light cream, and 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla extract. Now, how to make my grandmother's apple strudel. Mix apple slices, sugar, 1/2 cup of flour, and 1 teaspoon of cinnamon for the filling, and set aside. Mix the remaining ingredients for pie crust, reserving 1 egg white. Divide dough in 2 pieces and roll out 1/2 the dough to fit a 10 by 15 inch jelly roll pan with sides. Cover with apple mixture, roll out top crust and cover with the top crust, and brush the top with egg white. Slit the crust and bake at 350 for 45 to 60 minutes. For the icing, mix 1 cup of powdered sugar and 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla with enough cream or milk to make a thin frosting, and mix well and spread over the hot crust. Enjoy!
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.